Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 295, featuring Alan McKay, the famous Alan McKay, VFX supervisor, technical director, and owner of the brand Alan McKay. I'm just going to say that sort of jokingly, but he is a really good person that teaches a lot of artists about marketing and about how to sell yourself and what to do with your to do those types of things. The thing that was cool about Alan and I, we both started a podcast around the same time, which is coming up on 6 years ago. It was a lot of fun because he and I basically went on each other's podcasts at that time to sort of, you know, help cross promote or do whatever gets things started and sort of see how things are going. And he's a really great guy. And then he decided to have me back on his podcast. I said, well, you should be back on my podcast. So here we are 6 years later, and we're doing our little exchange program again. Kristen, what do you think of Alan?
Oh, it was really awesome. Like you said, if you want to know how to market yourself as a CG artist, listen to this. He has lots of good points. And you guys also talk about like the starving artist and how that's actually not true. And then show reels should be short and sweet to get you in the door. Yeah, it was all really interesting.
Yeah, it was really, really good. He makes a lot of good points, and he is really a great resource for a lot of people who are starting off and trying to figure out how to get a job. You know, learning the stuff is one thing, but then getting a job is another part of it that is actually a skill set that people may not necessarily have. So it's good to have him there. All right, cool. Really great to have Alan on, but let's talk about a little bit about some announcements we've got.
Yep. So you can find these at chaosgroup.com/events. The first one is it's been going on since September 17th, and it will end October 13th, but it's the Discover the Power of V-Ray 5 series. A lot of exclusive presentations, so you can sign up online for that. And then the other one is the Illumination Challenge, which we've also discussed. This is a student rendering challenge, and the deadline is November 30th. You have a chance to win V-Ray or Corona licenses or cloud credits.
Perfect. Yeah, and it's really cool for that Illumination Challenge. You guys should totally check it out. Remember, the deadline is November 30th. I also want to say that we're going to be at GTC. For those of you who know, obviously GTC is going to be remote again, or basically online event this year. And it's the GPU Technology Conference. We will be talking about Lavina, and we will be talking about V-Ray GPU and a lot of the advances we have done in the last 6 months or so on that product, on those products. So it's really cool to sort of see that. So that's going to be happening on Thursday, October 8th, between at 7 a.m. I don't remember when exactly, but it's really definitely go check it out, and it's going to be online. So just go look up GTC, and you'll be able to see that. And actually, I think I'm going to be at GTC. There's a video that I did that's going to be used there, so you should check that out as well. Again, all of these are at chaosgroup.com/events, and you should check them out there. We have a couple of other announcements. Kristen, what's going on? What are products going on?
So this is our news. You can find these out at chaosgroup.com, but these are ones we've talked about. V-Ray 5 for Houdini Beta is out, and the V-Ray 5 for C4D and Phoenix FD Update 3 is now available. And cool. The last one, if you want to talk about.
Yeah, coming soon, V-Ray 5 for SketchUp. So that's going to be happening pretty soon. So keep an eye out for that. We actually have a teaser out on our YouTube channel that you can check out. It's a very exciting. People seem to be very excited about it. So I am very excited as well. That's great. So remember, V-Ray 5 for SketchUp. All this information can be found at chaosgroup.com. If they want to know more about the podcast, Kristen, where can they go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Great. And if you guys have any other ideas or people you want to have on the podcast, let us know. labs@chaosgroup.com. We reach out to some of these people, we've had some great suggestions, and we'll totally take you up on it. Or if you have any comments or anything else, that'd be great. Also, if you'd like to rate us, review us, and share us with your friends, we can do that on Apple Podcasts. It's always a good place for us. Apple Podcast is a lot of great stuff going on there. So go check us out there. Give us a review. We would love to hear from you there. I should also note that we are, for the last several months, we have been doing these as videos. So they're also available on our YouTube channel, which is Chaos Group TV. In fact, I would like to apologize for not having shaved this morning. I was very, very lazy. In fact, I'm not even recording this in my normal place. I just sat at my desk and I said, Kristen, we're just going to do it from my desk and not try to get all my sound isolation. So you can enjoy this view of isolation Chris unshaven. so that's going on as well. And we're also on our Facebook channel. We post the videos there as well. And it was really cool. And in fact, I should note, you will see in the video how put together Alan is. He's got a full like studio behind him. And here I am, you know, sitting at my house and my headphones on. So it's kind of cool. So Alan, yeah, he's really cool. You should totally check out the video with Alan. It looks pretty sweet mm-hmm. setup he's got for his videos. All right. That being said, please enjoy this amazing podcast with Mr. Alan McKay.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Now, is this a studio setup that you have in your house to look for, do video recordings and Twitch channels and all that stuff?
I've never used Twitch in my life, but it's funny because when last time I was at Blur, I was just starting the podcast, and one of the guys at Blur sent me his Twitch thing, and he's like, you can watch me live playing video games, and I didn't know that was a thing, so yep. I'm like, why would I want to watch you play video games for hours streaming? But now that, like, that was like 6 years ago, and now that's like normal. So at right. the time, though, I was just like, what? That was Daryl over at Quixel. But, so I had an office downtown, and I just, like, the last 6 months, I hadn't stepped foot in there once. So I was just like, I'm burning all this money. So I decided to just move everything back into my home. And mm-hmm. It's only the last few weeks I decided to just go all out and purchase a video wall and get it all built and all that. But it's mainly just I want to start doing a lot of courses as well as just, yeah, a lot of stuff that I feel like it would be great to go. I've got a digital whiteboard over here as well, so I can just...
Oh, nice.
You know, I think in general it might just be not nicer than having a wooden wall like everyone else typically, you know, does.
I don't go too fancy. In fact, I never really thought about how am I going to deal with it. And, you know, I'm just recording these podcasts from my son's bedroom because it's the best soundproofing I have facing the bunk bed right now. So
that's actually pretty genius. I like it.
So, I was thinking about it. And so I just haven't gotten that thought about it, but that does bring up a point. And you and I started our podcast almost around the same time, almost exactly, which is coming up on what, 6 years now, right?
Yeah. End of 2014. So,
yeah. So 6 years we've been doing this. And when we first started, we said, hey, we should have each other on the podcasts, on each other's podcasts. And you just had me on your podcast. And I figured you'd be on my podcast now and see, like, in 6 years, there's a lot of things that have changed and that's gone on in your life and or mm-hmm. evolved. You know, you had some very lofty goals 6 years ago about what you were going to do and about teaching and how you're going to be a mentor and mentorship and all of that. And for the large part, I think you've actually pulled off a lot of that stuff. So tell us that journey. How did it go in the last 6 years?
Man, okay, yeah. it's been crazy because I don't know really what I had communicated back then. But yeah, it's kind of funny because there's like so many different directions I could go here because there's kind of like the stuff I don't usually talk about, which is like the marketing side. But like I've gotten not just doing the training stuff for the visual effects has been fun. But then on top of that, I started getting a lot of success in the marketing space too. So I started then teaching a lot of like 7- and 8-figure marketers how to do product launches, pricing psychology. So it's been kind of fun because that whole area, and I'll backpedal in a second, but that whole area was kind of like a blue ocean for me because obviously, you know, you and I have been around the block for quite a long time in visual effects. So it isn't really like there's much where you're starting from scratch. And it's like, you know, it's any new package, any new software, new features, it's usually, you know, you relate it to something else and you figure out the extra bits, and then, you know, it's nothing new. So it's going kind of into a whole new industry where, you know, I'm kind of expecting to be the humble, like, I just started, I'm, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. It's been kind of fun to kind of break ground in that area and do all that. But yeah, like in 2014, I'd already been selling courses and doing that stuff. And it's always been fun just because I feel like a lot of us don't share enough. And I also think that the most of the time, the way that we get our growth is through sharing knowledge, because it's, I might show a technique that I developed and then someone takes that and makes it way better. And then I'm learning from them. And I love that kind of growth that we all get. And it was only in 2014 I decided that I wanted to do like a full-blown like year-long mentorship. And that was because I'd done training with all the big companies. I'd helped a lot of them actually build their training companies up online. And I always got frustrated because it was usually like, let's say $700, you buy a course and it'd be a 6-week course and the teacher would help you out in the forums or something. And usually I would find at the very end, like at the 6th week, that's when people are like, okay, I'm starting to get it. And it's like, awesome. Okay, that's it. Goodbye. You know, and it just always made me think like, well, what if I spent a year with someone? Like, what kind of growth could they get? Right. And so that was just really exciting for me, just to kind of like actually spend a year with people. And a lot of those guys, they're still attending the live. Like I did a live demo reel review just with my students yesterday. And some of those guys were around from the first year, you know, and they're still hanging out. And that was really cool too, to kind of see like, one of the questions that came up was, here's my reel. I'm now a senior at Encore doing visual effects. Mm-hmm. Two of them were actually on that call. And they're like, I want to get into souping now. Like, that's the next level. And it's just to kind of see that trajectory of like trying to get their first job. And now it's like, okay, now I want to get into souping, you know. Mm-hmm. So what's your advice for that? That's what I think is just really cool, to kind of see that trajectory a lot of people have when they really pull away all the excuses and say, okay, I'm just going to shut the hell up and like really apply myself and make career first, rather than thinking just the software is going to, you know, be enough to kind of get me the success that I want.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? The software is constantly changing.
Yeah.
And if you just teach people how to push buttons, that button's going to go away in 6 months, possibly. So why would you, you know, it's more about teaching them the process of that, right? And I think you're right. If you do it over a long period of time, there is enough, like for a year, that student will have not just, you know, more time with you, but also see how things change over a year. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that's a really good, it's an excellent point. I remember when I was at Rice and I was first teaching, and this was back in 90. I was teaching Max and Maya at the same time. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did that is that I didn't want to teach them how to use Max and how to use Maya. I wanted to teach them the similarities between the two, or the differences between the two, so that if they encountered something else, they would say, oh, so, you know, it's, I'm looking for the thing that does this and this and this and that, you know, and there's a correlation that they can start to make between packages, because a lot of 3D packages are very similar, but if you've never seen one, it could look completely different, right? If someone's only used SketchUp and then they tossed into Houdini, it doesn't look anything like a 3D package. You know what I mean?
But that's the interesting thing. And I think that's really vital, because like a good example is you go to Industrial Light & Magic, or you go to a lot of bigger studios that rely more on proprietary software. And mm-hmm. these days it's not so much, because it's way more cost effective to use commercial software than out of the box, rather than developing your own and maintaining your own. But right. let's say back in the day, R&H, DD, and you know, the typical ones, like that would be the thing. Like you would go in there. It wasn't like you had 10 years to learn the software. It's mm-hmm. like, here's your 1 week of training. And then from there, get out there and start knocking out shots. But you know, a lot of people do cling on to, I'm going to go and learn software. One person told me, like not a student of mine, just someone emailed me like, I'm going to spend a year just learning Maya inside out. And then I'm going to go to ILM. Cause you know, and it's just like, dude, like, reading the manual, you know, maybe as a demo artist for Autodesk, but, you know, go and look at their reel and look at what type of stuff they do a lot of and mimic right. that, you know, and make yourself a good candidate to be hired.
I think people forget that it's not just, you're not just a technician, you're an artist, mm-hmm. right? and you have a responsibility to be an artist at the same time.
Well, you brought it up before, like, what, like, I did have one person email me kind of frustrated. He's like, you know, I shouldn't have to think, even though, like, especially a technical director, your job is literally just problem solving. But right. He's like, I shouldn't have to think. There should just be a button that I press. Like, I don't want to have to problem solve and do all these things. So I thought about that and I replied. I'm like, you probably could get a job somewhere doing that. But the thing is that what if someone comes along who can push the button better or can push it cheaper? You know, you're instantly and highly replaceable. And more importantly, if it is that kind of barrier of friction is so low, then it's very likely. I mean, I just this weekend I've never done any like really heavy coding, and I wrote a tool to edit in Premiere because Premiere doesn't really talk to anything. I wrote that in Python on Saturday, and then Sunday I discovered image recognition, and I'm like, well, screw like controlling the keyboard and mouse. Like, now I can actually visually get the program to see the buttons and do all this. So then it's like way more accurate and reliable than like mashing buttons and accidentally going format C over here or something. But right. But that's just it. Like, if all you're doing is so simple, then that's the stuff that will go to AI, that will go to machine learning, that will get outsourced. What you can't replace is talent. And the more that you don't rely on like banging the hammer as being like, I push the button. Because like, if you get really good at banging the hammer and you're like, well, I want to get better, you don't bang the hammer harder. You got to think of like, well, how do I do things better? And I really kind of stress that is it's kind of like saying, well, I know Excel and PowerPoint these days, like knowing Max and Maya and Houdini and everything else. Like, I've never used Blender in my life, but I'm pretty confident in a couple of days I could start working on shots and get shots out the door. And that's not me being great or talented or anything. It's because I would just go in saying, okay, where's the box button? Where's the, how do I add polygons? Like, you're just relating right. to the same stuff you've known before. And that's why someone could go from Max V-Ray to Maya V-Ray and not really, you know, feel too lost. They're going to say, where's Hypershade? You know, where's right. this? And it'll all eventually make sense because you're just connecting what you already knew before and apply it to the new thing.
Yeah, you have to sort of not necessarily know what the button, where the button is, but why there is a button and what that button means, because there you need to know what the equivalent button is in another package or why that exists. You know, like, what is a shader? Understand what a shader is. Don't just say to make glass, do this. Understand what the shader is. And then it's like, and therefore now you can make glass. You know what I mean? And therefore it's a little bit simpler to think of it that way.
Well, just to touch on this for a second, like PyroFX and Houdini, I'd never used that before. PyroFX is similar to Fume and everything for anyone listening, but like Fume and Phoenix I know very well. And so me jumping into another tool that I hadn't used, it's just like, okay, I'm looking for the emission, the density, the heat, you know, buoyancy, like the same parameters exist. They're all the same. It's just maybe the buttons might be worded a little bit differently or slightly different, but, you know, I really think it's just important to start focusing on, you know, first of all, like getting good as an artist, but also let's say if you want to get further ahead in your career, it's more about, well, what do I need to do like soft skill wise to get ahead? Because if I'm just relying on the software, what if that software gets acquired and goes downhill or something else happens and, you know, suddenly you're not using that anymore. So, you know, you don't want to go down with it. You want to be able to pivot and continue relying on the talent that you've built up over a decade.
Yeah. And I know, I mean, you're well known for a lot of the stuff you've done, especially in the effects world, right? A lot of it, you're really good at explosions and things of that nature.
I get jobs occasionally.
Yeah. So I know that you've been teaching a lot and mentoring in that area a lot. And it's been great. I know you actually use multiple packages. You mentioned Fume and you mentioned Pyro. I know you've been working with Phoenix as well. You've been doing stuff with us because we've been helping you guys out with whatever Phoenix needs you need. Yeah. And different tools may be different for different people. You know, some people like a Honda, some people like a BMW, and that's not necessarily, you know, a bad thing. And so I think those are good things to sort of check out. Okay, so you mentioned a couple things. I want to get back because you kind of skimmed over it and I was like, hold on, what did you say? And you're talking about the marketing thing and how you've been sort of helping people on a marketing side of things. And you mentioned it as there's a whole blue ocean out there for that area. And I know what a blue ocean is, by the way. I don't know if most people know what a blue ocean is. But a blue ocean is basically a very wide market that no one has identified yet and no one has seen. And so it's that's really what it means, right? What is this Blue Ocean? Explain to us what you're doing in the marketing side of things.
Yeah. So it's kind of been fascinating because I think that most of us, especially as artists, like we're kind of allergic to a lot of different things. Like, just to kind of touch on what I'd already been referring to, but I think a lot of times we like to be the artist, so we don't want to be the man and worry about business or things like that, because we kind of embrace the whole starving artist thing. And I think there's just like a lot of things that as artists we kind of like decide, well, I'm going to step into the artist persona, and we have this misconception that that means that I'll let my artwork speak for itself and I don't need to worry about business and all these other things. But then there's occasionally people I meet who are highly successful in their career and even making, and this to me sounds so unreal, but as in unbelievable, but there's 3D artists I know who are making mid six figures, even seven figures as a freelancer, which is just utterly insane. But they're not the unicorn. They're a few zeros short, but like they are the unicorn in terms of 3D, where for me, I've always had this mentality of you could probably make 50 grand in the industry as an artist. That's about your cap. That's the kind of invisible script I've always told myself. And so I mention all this just because for me, there's been a lot of things I kind of stayed away from my entire life. Like my roommate founded the company that made Fruit Ninja back in the day. I actually made the logo for it. And it's so funny, my friend's daughter is 2 years old and she's playing Fruit Ninja. And I'm like, I know that logo from somewhere. And I realized I'd made it when I was 17 years old as a gift to him. And he was someone who always told me like he wanted to get in the business side of things. And I never understood why artists would want to do that. But now that I realize the commonality I see in a lot of artists who embrace, like if you're a big studio, because I feel like studios and artists do the same thing. Like a studio will go get a job. They'll go and create the job. You know, they'll get the job through shopping a reel around and everything else. They complete the job for their client. Then an artist does the same thing. They have a reel. They go get work. They complete it for their client. They do exactly the same thing. It's just macro or micro. But I feel like the studios, though, they have accountants, they have IT, they have PR and marketing and all these other things. And artists typically don't worry about any of that stuff. And that's kind of the big downfall. So to segue into the whole marketing thing, I just think that it's such a neglected area that most of us feel like we're either selling out or showing off or whatever if we were to focus on marketing and stuff like that. And that's one thing is me selling online products. I'd always made some nice pocket change on the side selling training and things like that. And it wasn't until I decided to actually like properly start putting intent behind like the marketing and stuff. It's the same way if you sell 3D assets, because I had a lot of people on YouTube saying you cannot sell 3D assets, like there's no money in it and everything. And I thought about it for a long time. I thought, okay, people spend like a month making a model or maybe a week, but then they put all this work into making something, but then they just put it online and they walk away like, oh, no one's buying it, instead of actually doing some work to sell something. And as soon as I started to kind of put more work and effort into the marketing side, I started to realize like, wow, like most people are doing this wrong. They're not actually selling. They're not actually putting anything behind what they're doing. They're just going to put it out there like, oh, there you go. Instead of, thinking, well, what does the customer want? Like what are the barriers of resistance that are kind of, you know, preventing them from making the purchase in the first place. And the more I thought about it, the more I felt like I can actually serve people better that way. And I really got into pricing psychology. I dumped like 150 grand once just to really concrete this theory I had that people who pay attention. So the people who are looking at buying a $5 item, and if you sell your stuff really cheap, then they're going to treat it like a cheap thing. There's so many courses I've bought on Udemy on programming, machine learning, stuff like that, that I've never even opened because I bought it for $15 or whatever, even though it's probably great. And I think that a lot of us do that, where we don't see that there's much success because we tend to make something really cheap because we're afraid like no one's going to buy it otherwise. And because we're so unsure of ourselves, we lower the bar, and then that brings in people who then see it as a cheap product. And usually the people who are not paying as much are usually the ones who are demanding the most and also never satisfied. And whereas raising the prices, I found that people then are like, well, if I'm paying all this money, like I'm going to freaking get everything I can from this thing. Hugo Martin, the creative director over at id, responsible for Doom and Doom Eternal, like he's mentioning how when he studied, and I know I'm jumping around a bit, but bear with me, but he mentioned when he did his college tuition and everything, like studied at college, he wanted, that was his motivator to really make the most out of his career, because if he's paying all this money and he's still paying $1,100 a month to get it all done, then he's going to make it worth his while. So that was a big thing for me. It's just like marketing has been, you know, a really key part to like really get into. And because of that, I ended up really getting into the pricing psychology and figuring out like how to get quality customers, but also people who are really serious about like going through your training and making the most of it, rather than people who are just buying stuff and then they're like, I'm not really interested, or I'll do it later. And that that was something that I spent a lot of time on, but I realized that product launches and pricing psychology were two areas that I ended up spending a lot of time just really trying to figure out how to get a lot of success in that. But it meant that I ended up going and speaking with like John Lee Dumas and all these other big marketers at marketing events, you know, where they're doing like eight figures in a year and stuff that's utterly insane. And here I am, just like this 3D guy who, again, in my mind was doing, you know, 50K is all you can make in a year. And all that kind of happened in, you know, probably like 2 or 3 years, just from starting to realize like, hey, you know what, if you're going to do something, you know, do it properly. So if I'm going to make a product, I'm going to sell it. If I'm going to, you know, work on a mentorship, I'm going to spend a year on that, and I'm going to make sure that everyone who goes through it gets as much value and the results that they want from it. You know, the more that you put intent behind what you're doing, the more that you're going to get results that you probably wouldn't have else otherwise thought was possible.
Yes. I mean, there's a typical story that I've heard of someone that had a garage sale and they had a bunch of stuff, and they put all these prices out there, and they had all this leftover crap that was in the garage sale. And instead of just saying, someone's trying to give it away for free, and then they still wouldn't get rid of it, suddenly they put, they took the $2 sign off and put $15 in front of everything, and everything sold. Right? Because suddenly it seemed more valuable. And it was strange how that happens.
That's a story from Robert Cialdini, or Dr. Robert Cialdini. He wrote a book called Influence, which has become like one of the biggest books out there for NLP, or neuro-linguistic language programming. Right. So that's how people, like, behavior works through triggers. We're kind of pre-programmed. Like, everything is pre-programmed. Humans, animals, insects. Sure. And so, yeah, he had a friend of his that it was a jewelry store, but I'm sure it's kind of like evolved. The story has evolved over time. But yeah, she wasn't selling some like gems or something that she was trying to get rid of. So she just went away for the weekend, told one of her clerks, you know, just, you know, lower the price and get rid of the stuff. And she misheard and raised the prices, and it sold really well. So she contacted Cialdini and said like, hey, like, friend of hers, why did this happen? And he explained the whole psychology of like, you know, by raising the value, it actually made it more scarce and more valuable. So suddenly the cheap thing that people didn't want, they saw as valuable.
Yes, but that's an important, but there is a limit, right? You can't, if you have a piece of, you know, if suddenly, like, I don't know, what's the cost of Maya or Max these days? Like, let's say it's $3,000. I don't even remember it anymore. But if they suddenly raised it to $10,000, more people won't buy it, right? There's a thing that you can't necessarily raise the price of things and assume that it's going to, the thing. It's things that are undervalued. That's the problem, really. If you if they're undervalued, I think that's where it needs to be adjusted.
Well, it's perception of value. It's also how we work. Like, we can't process every bit of information that we have around us. So we have our RAS, which is our reticular activation system. I know we're talking so little about 3D right now, but
no, but this is important. Keep going.
I think this is really valuable. So like RAS basically will filter 90% of what I forget the exact percentage, but essentially like 90% of what we see and hear every single day out, because it's just too much for us to take in all the time, which is why, like, once you train your RAS, or in other words, like, you hear something one day and then suddenly you hear it everywhere, it's like, wow, I never even heard of this thing and now I'm seeing it everywhere. It's because you've now kind of filtered that to allow in. And that's something with, like, you know, the way I can explain like NLP would be, the easiest way would be, if you're price shopping or you're looking for a product online, typically you're going to say, okay, I want to get the best coffee machine. Usually you're going to sort by reviews and then just look for the most expensive one. And that's probably going to be the best one out there, right? Like, you just kind of set a few little conditions for it, and then said, okay, this means it's probably the best. And that's the perception, or the idea that or opinion you just make for that then is that this is the best because it's rated somewhere in the highest and, you know, it's the most expensive. So clearly it's the best. And that's just you trying to like simplify having to go through and read every review and everything else. So The reason that we are not going to buy Maya for 10 grand is because we already have done our homework. We're not going to go in there and then, you know, spend 10 grand something because we already know, like, hey, this isn't worth 10 grand. Like, it was
used to be 50 grand.
Well, that's what I was going to say is like 10 grand, like, you just go back in a time machine.
It used to be 50 grand for Maya. And yeah. I'm not kidding. That's how much it used to cost. And then it got dropped to 10 grand. I was like, oh my gosh, they dropped it. And the thing is, you have to, it's a market, right? You have to figure out how big is your market? How many people are going to buy it, right? There's only so many copies of Maya that people need in the world, right? Because there's only so many Maya's really focused on the film industry or on visual effects. Mm. And there's only so many movies done that need Maya, right? So there's a limited market. So they have to find a price that knows like, all right, if we spend this much money on R&D or whatever, and this is what goes into it. And so that's an interesting thing. Now, the reason I think it's important for I know you're a little focused on the audience. The thing that I think is important for our audience, for my audience to listen to, is there's a lot of people out there making things with their knowledge, right? With their 3D knowledge or whatever. Either they're making models, either they're making art, or they're making tutorials or whatever they're doing. And then they need to sell themselves and their products that they're making out there. And so these types of lessons, I think, are extraordinarily valuable for people to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's just the whole thing. Like, 'cause when we go back to marketing, like that really is one of those things that when we think marketing, we think we're selling something. But what we don't realize is that, again, talking about the macro and micro with studios and artists, we are selling ourselves. Like, we're always doing that. When you send your reel in, you're pitching, you know, I want to work on your project or work with you guys.
Right.
And your resume, everything, that is you doing your price breakdown of like, why am I worth this much? And this might be some kind of harsh reality for some people, and I'm sure plenty of people will disagree, but there are a lot of people who I've heard over the years will be like, you know, if I knew what I knew today, that VFX is a young man's game, I would never have entered into it because, you know, all these other people are coming in. I've been in the industry for 10 years and people are coming in who've got no experience and they're getting the job because they're cheaper. And for me, I always think, well, if you're competing with someone who has no experience and, you know, they're getting the job over you, like, what have you been doing the last 10 years with your career? Like, you know, like, that's the harsh truth. It's like,
right,
if you're still in the mailroom 10 years later, like, where was the intent behind your career? And the thing is that most of those people, it's not that they can't get better jobs and they can't do all these things. They can still redeem themselves in that regard. It's just, you need to start looking at, well, how do I make sense to someone else that, you know, price shopping, like, isn't the way, like, comparing myself to someone in the 99 cent bin isn't going to be where my value is. Like, my experience is going to save you money, and, you know, just learning how to position yourself, that's all personal brand. And that's something that I've been, the last 4 months during this whole COVID thing, like, that's where I've kind of been putting a lot of my time, is putting together a course on how to build a personal brand, specifically because now that we're all working from home, it's like a really beautiful thing. There's so much bad stuff going on right now, but like, this is one of the interesting things, is that what people didn't realize is that, you know, working from home was possible. Now it's proven that it is. So because of that, you don't need to be living in Vancouver paying $4,000 a month in rent. But at the same time,
you do if you want the tax subsidy, though.
Well, I've been really fascinated by that. Yeah, I've been thinking like, well, what's going to happen with tax subsidies if like all your employees are, you know, and that's the tricky part. But I'll just say this, like, now you can target any job on the planet. You're not locked into, I'm in LA or wherever. And that's why there's like people, like there's countries like Barbados and a few other ones that are actually saying, hey, come live in our country and like live the lifestyle because everyone's now virtual. But the interesting thing is that now you're also competing with everyone in the world. You're not competing with just the people in LA. You're now competing with everyone worldwide. And there are going to be plenty of people who are cheaper. And because of that, you're going to need to figure out, well, how do I message or position myself in a way that will validate why I'm worth 50 opposed to the $15 an hour person.
But that's okay. So cheaper is one thing. And maybe cheaper is the only thing. But to me, let's say, you know, when I was a supervisor and stuff, the harder challenge was actually finding talent, right? And I remember having a discussion with an accountant at one of my old companies, and she was like, "Why can't you just hire? Like, why you keep looking for people that require a visa? It's like, because I want talent. Yeah. I'm not. Yeah. I don't. You know. And you know, especially in the United States at that time. I mean, visual effects was treated like, you know, tractor trailer school. I mean, people were going to these schools that are like, yeah, learn how to be an animator. You know, and they're like, I don't know. I guess I don't have a job. I'll be an animator. And that's the way they were treated. Meanwhile, the really talented people in other countries were available. So. That's why, you know, listen, when I was at DD, like, I was the only American in my room, right? Everyone else was then on visas. And so that's a thing. So now but that's a challenge, and that's expensive for a company to support, sponsor people with visas, deal with legal fees, getting the visas. How many people can you let in? It's a big issue. Now, that's a little bit lower, right?
Yeah.
People, there's some fantastic artists I know. And I know some artists, for example, who live in São Paulo, who tried to move to the United States. They work for Disney. They loved it. And then they realized, I'm homesick and I don't like living in the United States. Yet they're very talented. They can continue to live in São Paulo and work to do all this stuff. So I think it's important.
Here's the thing too, is like, some employers are going to be, you know, always underbidding as much as they can, but a lot of people will value talent. But this is also the invisible script that a lot of us tell ourselves, that everyone else is cheaper and they're just looking for price. So the thing is, that's where a lot of artists, they're not communicating why they're more talented or what they can bring to the table. So if you say, I'm a 3D artist, you know, instead of saying, why do this, and try and separate yourself from everyone else, because a lot of people like to call themselves a generalist because they're afraid they're going to miss out on opportunity by ever niching down. And if you were to specialize, you're not saying I suck at everything else. You're saying you're doing something to kind of set yourself aside from everyone else. And the main, I'll just touch on this for a second to say that the main thing though is that it isn't usually that the employer is looking for someone cheap. It's that you fail to communicate what you do in a way that makes you different. So if someone looks at you and everyone else and you all look comparably the same, then they're going to say, well, okay, well, which one are you cheaper? But that's just because you're not doing your job in terms of branding and positioning yourself to say, well, I can do all these things, but the one thing I can do that's going to help you is X. And sometimes if you can just position that around a pain point that you're running into, like if their thing is that they're afraid they're going to lose their client, or they really want to have the confidence of the client, like whatever, the more questions you ask in an interview, the easier it is to figure out, okay, this is what I need to communicate that's going to make them be like, wow, we need this person, because they just pointed out a big problem that we're afraid of that they're able to really bring to the table to help us. And it might just be that, you know, I might be expensive, but your supervisors are way more expensive. And so you hiring this junior with the extra digit of revisions that they're going to be doing, that's going to cost you a lot more money in the long run if you're paying someone $1,000 or $1,500 a day and they're having to stay back late to, you know, revise things and give feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's like my grandfather's old saying is like, I'm too poor to buy cheap shoes. So, right. Because if you have to keep buying the shoes over and over again because they're so cheap, then it's too expensive, right?
I love that.
So, but that is something. And some people, and especially artists, right? They have a hard time seeing their value and their value literally as like, how much should I charge or what should I charge, right?
We have that starving artist mentality that, you know, that artists aren't meant to make much money, you know? And we get everyone around us telling us that while we're trying this difficult thing of starting a career in 3D, a lot of us are being told, like, go get a real job, you know, because no one understands why you're on a computer at 3 a.m.
Yeah. I mean, I had the same, I keep talking about it because I'm obsessed about it, but I've been tying flies, and this has been something I've sort of gotten obsessed with during COVID. And so I'm tying all these flies, and I've been posting them on these Facebook groups that I'm in. And this guy's like, hey, Sega, those are really nice. He's like, I'll buy some of those. I'm like, what? How much should I charged, like, he's like, I didn't know, you know. And I was like, should I sell him? He's like, no, I'll just give him away for free, because, you know. I was like, should I? No, I should, you know, as I think about it, I should charge enough that I can buy the material to make a whole bunch more, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So it was a thing that I was like, how much would I pay in a store for this? Like legitimately, you know? And so that was, but it's really hard when you look at something you've done and someone says, I'll buy it. There's that feeling that you're unsure of yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, I think you were alluding to before to like artists selling products and things like that too. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, I'm happy to talk about that. I think that it is interesting because most people don't know what to charge for something.
And right.
Sometimes it is like, well, why don't you just do some, you know, split testing and see what works? I mean, you could easily go on Facebook and set up 3 ads that go to 3 different pages and just have different prices and start seeing, well, you know what? I was selling it for $10, but then I did it for $100 and holy crap, people bought it. You know,
right.
And then after a while, like one example I'll give for a second, I don't know why, but I always end up talking about my wife because she's a designer. She does like vehicle wraps.
Right.
And I think it's just because I'm always talking with her about her business. But
right.
something that she would never do is like her industry, people pay for a vehicle wrap for like, you know, a couple $100. But then she does stuff that's very different. She doesn't go on Shutterstock and just slap a texture on a car and be like, here right. you go, which is what everyone else does. So for her, it's just like they're hand-drawn. Like she's done stuff for 50 Cent, a lot of other big celebrities, and she'll hand-draw everything and put so much work into it. So I've always said to raise your prices. And I think that there is always that worry that, well, no one's going to buy my stuff and I'll go broke, you know. But the thing is that the people who do buy, and this goes back to pricing psychology, the people who do buy it are going to be the ones who really value it and they love it and they're willing to pay the extra money. And if you only get 2 clients instead of 10, but these 2 are a dream to work with. They value you. That's why they're paying so much. Usually you're going to get the same amount of money that you would have for those 10 people with, you know, a fifth the work or whatever. So that I think is really critical to think about, is that by doing less but raising your prices, it means that you've got more time to put love into what you're doing rather than constantly trying to chase the sale.
Well, yeah. And that's a great point. That's a great point. And that's the thing where she loves what she does and she really enjoys doing it, right?
So she gets to make the client ultra happy because she puts all of her time into their product, you know, it makes
right.
it worth it.
And she doesn't want to just bang out, you know, thousands exactly. of cheap cars. And she, that's what she wants to do. And so that's an important part of it as well. I absolutely mm-hmm. agree that people should be considering that. But at the same time, I think that that's something that everyone needs to look at. Look at the, you know, I technically work in marketing now, mm-hmm. partially at my company. So I've learned a lot of things that I didn't know about, like, you know, identifying the customer, what is their persona? What are they going to do? How much do they, yeah. you know, all of those types of things. So I have a friend of mine, for example, that he created a program or a plugin, and he wanted to target the ArcViz community. And it's like $100. You sell it mm-hmm. for $100, you'll get a ton of customers. Because there's a ton of ArcViz people out there, right? A ton yeah. of them. And he goes, well, it's really hard to make this. I was like, I'm sure it is. And he goes, so he priced it at $600. Very few sales because $600 is very expensive for an ArcViz person. But there's a mm-hmm. ton of them. If you set it at $100, you're going to make 20 times more sales than at $600, you know?
Yeah.
So you have to sort of see the balance and really understand that market, right? So... Mm-hmm. It's hard.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely hard. I think it's fascinating, the marketing thing and how to understand that, because I think it's also, it comes down to the same thing you were talking about, you know, your resume and your demo reel, right? How do you mm-hmm. how do you sell yourself, not just mm-hmm. in terms of price, but in terms of the quality of work? So what are some of the secrets? What are some of the things you tell people when they're putting their demo reel out there, when they're doing things? What are some of the things you tell people that are how to sell your work?
Yeah, it's funny because I just did a webinar with my private students yesterday. I did 2 actually on exactly this. So you'd think that this would all be front of mind. But I mean, I think in general, like the typical thing is that most people, they don't realize how volatile the review process is. And I think that, like, I always talk about empathy in terms of, and this is more of a marketing thing, like the more that you put yourself in the shoes of the other person, the more that you can start to realize like what you need to do and everything else. And so that comes down to, like, even as a 3D artist, you know, I feel like I sucked until I started to actually, instead of doing what someone told me to do, make it 10% bigger. Okay, dollars.value times, you know, 10%, you know, there's your 10%. As soon as I started to actually think, well, okay, they're saying they want it bigger, the more I started to think about like what they're really saying, suddenly, you know, I go from being checked on several times a day to actually being trusted and left alone, being brought in to give my opinion on certain things. Like, people started to value me because I actually was doing my job instead of just doing what I was told and taking ownership over my work. Now, at the same time, when it comes to reviewing your reel, I think that, you know, I find it fascinating going on YouTube, like posting videos on YouTube, because the comments people say, like, this is just really great feedback, because there are going to be people who are just like blatantly shooting you down about everything. And it's interesting to get that pushback occasionally. So when I say to someone, you know, if you make a 5-minute reel and you save your best work to the very end, chances are no one's ever going to get to the end. And so put your best work at the front, you know, start with your best, end on some of the best. Your worst shots should never be in there in the first place. You know, the basic stuff, but.
And people shouldn't be afraid to have short reels too.
No, like someone had a reel yesterday of 30 seconds. I'm like, this is perfect. And I was chatting with my team last night and we're like, that was the best reel. All of it was CG. So that was the one thing I said to him, because he's in Washington, D.C. And I figured if he wants to get in New York or somewhere like that, he should go back and just like, don't change a thing. Just go and shoot plates and track them all in. Like, just to show that you can take a shot to finish, to completion, because that's the thing. Hiring anyone's a gamble. Like, it always is. And what I want to know is not that you can make an explosion on black. Anyone can make an explosion, but that you can actually finish a shot. Because otherwise, like, I get so many people that they get about halfway there and they've already overcomplicated their setup, where if I say change the gravity slightly, that's like a 2-day turnaround instead of it being a real-time thing. Because they're just banging the hammer, like I said, and they're not thinking about strategy. But the main thing with thinking about the person reviewing it is, the more that you put yourself in their shoes, the more that you might realize, you know what, when they're looking to hire, they're not just looking at reels all day long. Like, they're looking to hire a certain person. They're probably going to get a spreadsheet of 100 names and they've got to go through all of them. But hiring someone is not their job. Like, hiring is this distraction that they've been tasked with, but they've got to manage a team. They got to attend meetings. They got to do bids on upcoming projects. They got to do damage control, all this other stuff. And their time is valuable. They've got 100 people talking to them. On top of that, you're a name in a spreadsheet. So you've got to figure out how to capture their attention and do it in a way that also retains their attention throughout the whole thing. So shorter is better, absolutely, because that way they're more likely to get through the whole thing. Even setting context, like, if you don't mention, you know, name and title, like, if they're a smaller studio, they might be getting lots of reels, like 3D reels. Or even if you say 3D artist, like, I don't know what I'm looking at. So I might be looking at stuff and be like, at the very end, it says effects TD. And I'm like, I've been looking at the lighting the whole time. Like, who's the lighting person? I want to hire them. So that's just something you got to think about, is like setting context. That way they know what they're going to look at. And on top of that, keeping it short. I think that sometimes it's good to leave your phone number, stuff like that, on your reel if you're local, just because there's times that we end up hiring the second best person just because that person had a phone number. So we emailed the other person. By the time they replied, we'd already filled the position. So this is like a lot of small things, but most people think, if I send in my reel, you know, of course they're going to look at it. Like, why wouldn't they? And they can't get over the fact that, no, like, if your intro is 20 seconds, I've already skipped it. I've already gone to the next one.
You know? I'll give because I've reviewed lots of reels myself, and so have you, I know. But here's a scenario for people making reels. You're assigned to hire artists, and you are really busy, as you said, doing your job, your every job. So you're sitting with a sandwich at your desk during lunch, and that's your time to look at reels.
Yeah.
And you got to get through like 20 or 30 of them.
And we're not wearing our freaking headphones either.
No. Right? And I got to get through it because I got to answer emails and other stuff. Yeah. And I'm looking through these reels. And if it's slow and I like, come on, let's go, let's see what you got, it's not going to work. So boom, 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 boom. I think you're absolutely right. And then if you get someone's attention enough, because basically, let's just put it this way, you only have about 10% of my attention because I'm so busy and freaking out about other things. You have to give me something right at the start that says you warrant more than 10% of my attention, right?
What you really want, you want to, sorry to cut you off, like, I'll say this, like, you want to have a reel that the shot is so cool that they literally spit their sandwich out and say, everyone, come check this out. This is awesome. And that's when you're all nerding out about that reel. Because again, like if you've got five reels that all look the same, and then there's one person who managed to do something, again, like maybe instead of saying 3D artist, they said large-scale water simulation guy, whatever it is, at least something to differentiate how you're naming yourself and everything else. At least then, if they're all the same, they're like, well, what about the large-scale water simulation guy? Like at least something to stand out. And especially because usually you are just a name in a spreadsheet, your cover letter and everything else potentially gets stripped down. You know, there's a lot of strategy you can do. And that's why I think also if you're applying, like don't typically go through just the online application form, like look people up and try to get in through the side door, because that way you've got all their attention rather than sitting dormant in a database until they need you. You could already be front of mind talking to them and building that relationship. And again, like most times we hire on relationship over a reel or anything else.
Yes, it's true. Definitely true. But I want to, we're going to run out of time and I still have lots of things I want to cover. How
I always thought that you always talk for an hour and I'm like, man, like, you know, it's respectful, but at the same time, there's interviews you've had where I'm like, dude, like 10 more minutes, please.
No.
You're doing such gold.
I want to ask about like how things have changed over the last 6 years. And obviously several things we mentioned already, but what have you seen in the trend of the kinds of artists that have changed over the last 6 years? Are you seeing, like you mentioned the term generalist. Generalist is not a dirty word as much as it used to be. It's actually really a good thing now to be a generalist. What are some of the changes you've seen about how an artist is and how they present themselves and what succeeds that's changed in that time?
You're right. Like, I'll say like a generalist, the way I see careers is like an hourglass. So like you should always start as a generalist, even if you're not, like you should be learning the lay of the land. And then I feel like you kind of specialize and then you start to go general again as you move into supervising, directing or anything else. So I think in general, that's kind of like, you know, you need to specialize to kind of stand out at one point, but always start out broad so you know the lay of the land. But in terms of all this, I say like effects and lighting have always felt were two of the more higher in demand areas of visual effects, just because modeling and everything else is so competitive that it's also earlier in the pipeline. I feel like there's a lot of effects people these days just like being pumped out left and right. But
really,
I also feel like a lot of them tend to just make explosions on black and send them in. And that's what I mean. Like for me, I want to see finished shots because it also gives me a good indicator about like if there's a piece of debris that disappears in the shot, like that's, you know, the fact that I made it on your reel, that's going to be like, well, you let that slide. What are you going to let slide on my production? But I'd say, I don't know specifically about per artist, but I feel like real time has become more valuable. Usually film people kind of stayed in the film world and game people in game world, and game people might hire people from the film world. But now I'm really fascinated by the fact that real time has sometimes been the end of the pipeline. Like you go through comp and then you go back into real time. Now with COVID and everything, it's changed even more where virtual production is about to blow up in a big way. So there's that massive trend that people a year or two from now are going to be like, man, if only I'd gotten on that sooner. So I think that's kind of interesting. And but I don't know, in terms of like how artists have changed, I think it's been probably more about people are, it's the same stuff happening over and over again. There's a lot of people who are definitely starting to kind of drink the Kool-Aid of this software is better or that's better without there being any validity behind it. And so I think that there's a lot of people kind of lost in that. And so they end up, let's say, learning the really complicated software first and they get confused and then they never get off the ground. There's a lot of that kind of stuff. So I don't think there's really been a major shift in terms of how people work or are. It's just there's been maybe certain things have become a lot easier to do, and because of that I feel like certain artists have become a bit lazier in terms of, you know, not earning it, so they don't really push themselves as hard as they should.
So okay, so what is causing them to not be pushed so hard? What do you think is the situation? Is it the work's different, or the software's changed, or
again, I think explosions, effects is probably one of those areas that definitely is a cool factor to it. So a lot of people want to do that. Like you and I, when we were in 3D in the beginning, like shaded viewports were not even a thing, let alone real-time rendering and everything else. And I feel like a lot of what really gets you to be good is the struggle. You know, it's earning your stripes through, like, it's the same way I've got friends of mine who were kind of just given their first job. They didn't suffer and get rejected and just go through that a lot at the beginning. And because of that, they didn't really test themselves. They didn't push themselves. The same way that starting out on a 286 or whatever, you know, that we all started on, you know, you learn to be efficient. Like, everyone's talking about, like, you know, how do I get like a supercomputer and everything? And I feel like saying, like, start on a crappy PC, that's your secret weapon, because it's going to make you learn to do amazing things and think creatively. Like, okay, if I can't render this all in one go, I'm going to have to break it into foreground, midground, background. I'm going to have to be creative with everything I'm doing and figure out these solutions. And when it's all handed to you on a platter, I feel like it's just like, okay, cool. Now, you know, I've got a bolt in my warehouse in the corner there that's a million polys, because why not, you know? And it's just people aren't really having that etiquette around, like, how to be efficient, how to think ahead, how to plan, because there's no restraint to what they're doing.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we are getting a little spoiled these days. I mean, we were talking about the possibility and doing a bunch of benchmarking stuff, and there's some new hardware I'm testing, and they're looking. I was like, well, we'd love to test something that can be, because this system can go up to 2 terabytes of RAM, and like, wow. It's like,
I remember I soldered 1 megabyte,
right? Yeah. And I was like, hold on, you want? And they says, like, what if, can you render something at 512 gigs of RAM? I was like, yes, but if someone did, but I don't, but it was, I mean, that doesn't mean anything. It's like, you know what I mean? And so you have to find is, like, is it worth it? You know, like, can you really make it worth it to do those types of things? And there is some incredible hardware out there right now. And there, it's enabling a lot of great stuff that people are doing. But yeah, I think you were mentioning, it's like, restrict yourself, right? Then sometimes that's a better system.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll say this quickly. I was working late one night on Superman Returns back in 2006, and Jeremy Battelle, he's one of the soups over at DD. Jeremy's awesome. He got this supercomputer that none of us had, and I remember asking him, like, so what's it like on that computer? And he's like, it's exactly the same as every other computer. It's just now I notice how slow all the other computers are. And it's kind of that thing that, like, as soon as you get to the faster one, it's not like, now I can do more. It's right. That you could do, you know, you're doing less on the other ones. You're feeling that restraint. So nothing's ever fast enough. It's just when you're slower, you got to think and maneuver a bit differently.
Yeah. Yeah. My friend, Chris Blythe, who lives in Kenya, do you know Chris? I don't know if you know Chris.
It rings a bell for some reason.
But he was in Kenya, and he was talking about, like, these Kenyan gamers, right? And they're all on really, really crappy computers and really bad internet. And they're doing pretty good. And then suddenly they're in front of a good computer with a good internet, and they're kicking ass, right? Because they've been held back. And it's like, it's just like altitude training and running, you know, you go high. And then once you go to lower altitude, you're like, whoa, I can fly. So it's the same idea. So, you know, you're right. Restrict yourself. And then you're also, you know, I've said it before, is like, restriction actually enables more creativity. It's like, you can't do it. Mm-hmm. You find more creative solutions to do some of the things you're supposed to do, right?
You mentioned Kenya, like, Nigeria is a good example, like Nollywood. Like, you get people out there, and obviously they're making films for their community rather than for, you know, big budget things. But like, again, like, when you have a crappy camcorder, like, but that's all you have, then suddenly you're using that as your weapon and you're able to do so much. I remember, during COVID, there's a friend of mine, I end up giving him like 10 grand of camera gear that I knew I just wouldn't ever touch. So I'm like, here's a DJI Ronin 1, a Blackmagic production camera, like all these things. So here's all the stuff. And I was expecting him to go out and start filming. And he's like, oh, well, I can't because everyone's in quarantine. And I'm like, dude, like, this is where you can go shoot your B-roll. You can do, you know, all this other stuff. You can board out your ideas. Like, you got all these other people who have nothing and they're going out and doing amazing things, but other people are building those excuses not to get out there and try. So yeah, you know, you've got so many, like, so many options. Like, your phone can make films now, and it's just insane to see, like, what you can do. And
yeah, the new restrictions. The new Samsung phone will record at 8K, which is insane, you know.
Yeah, and Blackmagic, the new Ursa came out as 12K. It's just like, that's insane.
Right.
Yeah, but that's just it. Like, the barrier has been set so low now, like, you can do anything. Like, I've got I thought about this recently. I've got more friends who are feature film directors than I can count on my hand, hands these days. And most of them came from visual effects. And they just decided, like, I want to go and do this. So they go and make a short film or whatever. And we've got mutual friends like Kevin and everyone else who they want to go do it. Dave Wilson, Tim, everyone. Like,
yeah.
Funny that they're all from the same place. But
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, Rory, everyone. Like, there's so many people doing amazing stuff just because they decide to go do it, whereas other people make the excuse. They're like, ah, well, I could never do that, or whatever they tell themselves, you know, instead of just saying, go make a short film and see what happens, you know?
Right. Because you know what you're going to do? You're going to make a lot of mistakes. And then, you know, the next time you do it, it'll be better.
but that's right? it. Like, that's what I was saying about restriction. Like, the mistakes and the restraint and everything else makes it. Like, I'll quickly say this. Like, yes, there's reviewing someone's reel. Really cool stuff. There's one shot that he had his pink crappy monster he got and threw into Mixamo and animated it. And I was saying, like, people are going to look past that. They're not going to be like, oh, what a crappy model. He had this big monster smashing a building. But I said, what you could do, though, is you could go on Instagram right now and find, using the ZBrush hashtag, a bunch of people who've done amazing creatures and say, here's this shot. I would love to use your creature in it. And the two of you start collaborating on that. And it means that they get a cool thing for their reel instead of a turntable, and you get a finished creature. But on top of that, you just went and built that relationship. And the two of you then will be like, well, what else can we do? And you never know. And he had just told me how he'd been hustling and been working two jobs and doing all this stuff. So I knew that he had the personality that was perfect to go do that. He's not going to be like, I don't want to talk to someone online. Like, that sounds bad, you know? I just hit up one of the guys who works at UFC, does all the motion graphics at the UFC headquarters. And, you know, I'm like, hey, I got an After Effects question. And you know, it's just, there's so many relationships you can build. And again, like, the two of you might end up making short films and doing all this cool stuff together. Like, there's so much opportunity out there. And most of us are just not willing to, you know, think creatively about how we can leverage that.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, obviously, two people do try to collaborate and you know, students try to collaborate and make short films together. And that's great. But I think you specifically identify as like, okay, I'm an effects person and I just need a character thing, but I'm not a character guy. Maybe I can get a character guy and he gets a really cool effect for his character and I get a really cool character for my effect, you know?
Exactly.
And that's a brilliant idea to collaborate that way. Yeah, people should do that more often.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Then they can hit you guys up and say, we've been doing this cool stuff. We're making a short film. We don't have the render power.
Right.
Do you want to slap your logo? I don't want to give people ideas, but it's like, do you want to slap your logo on a thing and give us some, you know, Chaos Group credits?
Yeah, and we do. You know what? The thing is, we do that. We absolutely do that. A lot of people come up with ideas and they show us and we help them out. That's something that's very important to us. You know, we call it Partners in Art. And that's how we make sure that people have that ability. Now, of course, we're not just say, hey, I want free software. That's not how it works.
But you earn it. You front load the work and then you say, this is how far we got. And now we're hitting a wall and we want to get over that wall. We need help.
Yeah,
you don't do it up front like, I want to make a short film, so hand out, you know?
No. And the thing is, you know, in the Chaos Group, it's about our community, right? Our community is extremely important, and it's very big now. It's very, very big community. I actually would really like more collaboration because Chaos Group tends to appeal to different industries. I'd like more interdisciplinary collaboration to happen, but who knows?
We'll see. I think that'd be great. And well, just to touch this for a second, like, I'm sure we have like 100 mutual friends that are in this area of like, I always refer to the Michigan migration is what I call it, but I've got so many friends who came from like ArcViz or Cars Detroit, and they all made it to LA. And it was one of these things that you are really good at lighting and rendering. Mm-hmm. And then let's say you want to go work in VFX somewhere, like, look at the skills you've got, because a lot of people are like, I don't want to start my career over or whatever, but it's like, leverage what you know. And there's so many people who've gone and learned ArcViz and they're like, well, I'd love to go do stuff on TV or whatever. And you can go and use that and shift or pivot into a different industry.
Right.
And at the same time, in your spare time, maybe you want to destroy some buildings instead of making buildings or whatever it might be. But there's other people who, you know, maybe they want to learn a craft and two of you can team up. There's so much talent out there. It's insane. So, you know, especially Instagram, ArtStation, places like that, you can go and see all these other people and just like hit them up and say, hey, I love your work. You never know what could happen.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I've You're speaking to someone who's changed his career many times. But I didn't, it's not necessarily a change. It's a shift, right? There's a lot that I bring from my old career to the new career, right? Mm-hmm. Like when I went to work at DD and I was I went from like, okay, so now I'm doing buildings for architecture and now I'm doing buildings for day after tomorrow, right? So I know what a building is supposed to look like, and suddenly like, oh, well, Chris knows how to make a building look like a real building because he used to design them. So you have those skills. And what's interesting to me about you, Alan, is that you're when you started talking about the marketing thing and about how to sell things, that's very interesting, because what I've learned from you is that 6 years ago, you had started you'd always been doing your tutorials, but you kind of mentioned much more formal and the bigger scale thing that you wanted to do in terms of education. And what you've learned in that time is a marketing skill, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you've learned that marketing skill, and it's good. It's good. It's very good that you're doing that. But now all of a sudden, it's like, maybe I can teach some of that to other people as well.
Yeah.
So you have changed careers yourself as a marketer.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting because, like, I'll touch on this because I think people can relate to it. Like, there's definitely that part of me that, like, I still do shots, I still work on projects, but I'm more picky. Like, I worked on the last feature film would have been Bloodshot, and that's because Dave Wilson and Chris Harvey hit me up, and they're like, we're delivering the movie in 4 days, and we just, you know, axed a big thing that we need to get done. And but there's that sort of stuff pops up all the time. And then same thing, God of War, I assume I can mention it, but like Raf Grizzetti hit me up on Instagram. He's like, hey, you know, do you want to come and work on God of War? There's like a position available, and I ended up not taking it. But then the person who took it was like, his first thing he said was, can we get Alan on this project? So then they came back again. And but so there's projects that pop up that I'm just a little more picky about. So if it's with the right people and the right things, then I'm like, yeah, that sounds fun. So I think that in general, that's the benefit, is that once you kind of get a lot of success in your career, it means that instead of doing outbound, like having to do outreach and try and chase jobs, you instead get to just open your inbox. And that's all of us. Like, we get to, you know, pick and choose the projects we want to work on. And for me, like the one thing I was leading to was that there's occasionally times where I'm like, crap, if I keep doing this, like, am I going to become irrelevant? But it's always been the thing, the same way that if I just, the times where I was just souping and not doing any on the box work, there'd be those times where I'm thinking, well, if I keep this up, I won't be relevant anymore. And it's like, well, wait a minute, why do I want to cling to like being on the box all the time? And for me, it's always been like looking at what the next step is in your career. And for me, that's where now there is a lot that I've learned from hanging out with all these you know, really successful people in this other space, that now suddenly I'm like, well, crap, like that's the hidden thing that all the artists are doing wrong, is that no one is learning to market themselves properly. And it's not about like selling out, and that's the thing, a lot of us have this kind of idea in our head that, you know, you don't want to show off or anything else, but it's not. It's how do I communicate my skills effectively that I am then able to say I want $100 an hour or whatever it might be.
Right.
And for them not to, you know, spit on the ground and be like, holy crap, like what the hell? Instead be like, yeah, that makes total sense. Mm-hmm. And the more that I've done that, the more I've realized like even how you approach jobs, you know, maybe doing bidding and positioning yourself more as a vendor opposed to an artist. That was one interesting thing, is I hit a cap with my hourly rate where I couldn't compete with everyone else for the longest time, because if I started saying I want a higher rate, they're like, well, no one else has ever asked for that here. But then if I say, well, I'll do it for 20 grand, they're like, okay. And that was the, you know, twice or three times the hourly rate I would have asked. And it's just because that empathy I'm talking about, like I'm speaking to a producer instead of these dynamic interchangeable numbers where if I go and work the weekend and they don't know, suddenly they lose like 3 grand or something. That kind of stuff can happen. And they're always afraid of that. Like, you know, what's the end budget going to be? Are we going to be in the red? But if I go along and say, I'll do it for this, or even ask them, most of the time these days I do that. I just say, what's your budget? And they say 20 grand, 30 grand. I'll say, I'll do it for 35. You're speaking their language. And so suddenly they're like, cool. Well, as long as we don't go and ask for 100 more things that we didn't, you know, discuss up front, then we know that that's locked in the budget. Suddenly they're not
a fixed cost.
The producer isn't going, you know, stay up at night, like, oh my God, like, what's this going to cost? It's like, now Alan's bit is taken care of. Like, as long as he delivers,
right,
we don't have to worry about this, like, blowing out a budget or anything. And that's the sort of stuff that, in a lot of ways, is actually making them happy. Like, they mightn't care as much about the price if it means that they've got one less thing to worry about. And, you know, the one thing about producers and managers is that they've got the toughest job in the world because they're not physically doing the work. So when they get the client breathing down their neck, there's nothing they can do other than yell if that's the personality they have. So they're kind of stuck in the middle of like, please, can someone deliver the work that we need? So it's very stressful. But if you can give them the kind of, you know, the relaxing idea of like, well, I don't have to worry about that anymore, then that's like one less thing and actually is worth more money to a lot of people than the stress of something, but also getting to penny pinch to, yeah, you know, keep things under budget.
Yeah, that's a great point. So I have a question for you. We've talked about the last 6 years. What about the next 6 years? What do you think about the post 2020 world, right? Like, what, mm-hmm, there's obviously, we don't know where the dust is going to settle, but there's definitely going to be a different landscape when it does settle. And I'm wondering, mm-hmm, what do you think that landscape is going to look like? And what do people have to do to get ready for that?
Man, yeah, there's so many smarter people than me that should be asked this question instead of me. But
I think you have a good insight into the industry and you've seen the, mm-hmm, trends and you've seen that. I'm sure you have some feelings about that.
So virtual production is definitely, as I mentioned before, has become like a big thing. And it's not really like that's mainstream. It's just there's so much talk in the lull of like when people weren't shooting, because a lot of people are starting to go back to shooting now. And a lot of other studios are looking at the studios who were shooting, like, okay, are you getting sick or can we start getting back? So,
right,
you know, everyone's typically working on sound stages or location, but virtual production is definitely limiting the amount of people needing to be necessarily on set, especially mixing the talent together and everything else. And that is about to blow up in such a big way. There's so many people I've been talking to who are really the forefront of this, but it's an expensive investment to do. But I think that just like anything, it's expensive at the beginning. LiDAR, I have a $20,000 Leica BLK LiDAR over there, and like it's rumored the next iPad Pro is going to have LiDAR. You know what I mean?
Right. So things does, are yeah.
So that's one thing that I think will be really interesting. The work from home thing has definitely put everything, you know, upside down in a lot of ways. It's open the world up. And I think that that's going to be interesting in so many different ways. And I'm excited for that. I think that it kind of gives, I don't think that everyone's going to end up working from home, but I do think that a lot of people will start to kind of break into their little freelance pockets and everyone kind of end up being a mini vendor for another vendor of another vendor. And the whole hierarchy happens. And that started with Scarecrow back in like 2009. They were the first in San Fran to try to do the whole virtual production stuff. Mm-hmm. But with cloud rendering and where everything else is going, PCOIP, that's all shifting. I think it's kind of interesting. What I do find interesting right now is that there's such a lack of content. And this isn't something that I've read. It's just more of an observation. So I'm interested to see what happens here. But we've gone through the decade of, like, I've always described the big studios, the big five, as being a bank. Because, like, I sat in some meetings probably like 15 years ago where I had that realization, like, you're not a studio, you're a bank. Like, the way that they work, I've been told, like, we don't care if you make $50 million profit. We want $150 million profit. Otherwise, we don't care about you. Like, that's the stuff that I've been told to my face. And that's made me realize that that's how they function. So then it wasn't a big surprise when suddenly we weren't getting original ideas. The worst thing you could do when you pitch an idea is to say, this is brilliant and no one's ever done this before. They're like, get the hell out of our office. What they want is you to say, well, this is like this this $1 billion movie and this other one that was highly successful. Because for them, they're like, cool, well, if we market it twice as hard, it's going to sell even more. Awesome. We'll bring it back to the theaters for a second round. Now, because of that, there's not been any original content for a long time. Now that everyone isn't shooting anymore, Netflix and all the streaming services are purchasing as much content as they can that has been shopped around and no one's picked up. So because of that, people are actually liking original content, and it's kind of proving that there actually is interest beyond doing a DC or Marvel film again or another Star Wars. So I think that those are still going to be around, but now I think we might start to ease back into getting original content again, original scripts that weren't picked up for the last 10 years. So I'm excited for that, just to see fun, unique stuff come to screen that isn't, you know, a massive budget film.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's so much more, but I think, like, not to do what, you know, I'm going to do here, but I think you guys, like, with all the stuff that you guys are doing, it's I'm really fascinated by that because I'll say this with software. Like, software is very political, and, you know, I've hated that because there's been times where people are like, Alan, which is better, this or this? And I'm like, I can't say because, you know, I'm going to get my ass kicked by someone. And that's been interesting with Chaos Group is that you've got this company that, you know, is financially stable and doing really well, is in touch with the customer base. They actually are driven a lot by the customers. And so you're doing everything right, opposed to being a big conglomerate or not being big enough. Like, when a few companies that got acquired more recently, even some of your competitors who got bought out by bigger software companies, but I was happy for them at the time because it's like, cool, now you've got legs to do something. Whereas before you were 2.5 people. And that's the sort of stuff that, you know, with you guys, I think that you've got that perfect mix. Like, I've always thought I can bank on you guys if I were to pick software, just because I know that you guys will be around and you'll evolve, and you're also more in tune with the customer base than a lot of other people might be. So because of that, you know, I know that my time is valuable, but I can invest into a company in terms of my time in a way that I know that it's worthwhile. I'm not like learning something that's not going to be around 5 years from now. So that's also interesting just to look at, is like which companies are going in which direction. I will say something because I forgot, like I mentioned to one of my team when you were on my podcast, you know, hey, I'm about to jump on a call with Chris, and I didn't check my messages until afterwards, but there was a question that just came to my mind, but one of my buddies, Troy, was like, so can you ask Chris like when you guys are going to buy Max? So, and I thought about that for a minute. I'm like, wow, that's a brilliant idea. So yeah. I'm going to plant the seed.
Yeah. All right. I'll mention it to Vlado and Peter and see if they have some investment in buying Max. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's really hard to develop those things. But yeah, you know, it's interesting. I agree with everything you said about the future. I think virtual production is, and it's not just going to be a fad, right? It's going to prove that the pandemic enabled that to be important, because I think people were getting lazy and making extraordinarily expensive movies that don't need to be very expensive.
Yeah.
Right? You don't need to pay $400 million to make a movie. It's insane. It's insane.
Sorry, Jim.
Sorry, you don't. But there is huge demand for content, and you mentioned the original content as well. It's like, it's really great. They people never took the risks of original content because movies were so expensive to make, and now they are. You know, now there's an opportunity to do that. So I actually do think that's the case. I also think that you know, something we mentioned earlier, the new hardware and new software and real time is actually going to change the filmmaking process too, and the way people think about filmmaking.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be great. I mean, that goes hand in hand with virtual production though. I think you're absolutely right. I'm excited to see what that's going to do. I'm excited what this does to the artists as well. You know, the remote artist is going to be fine, you know, and even just like, listen, I'll come to the office. Like, even if I'm in the same city, I'll come to the office like twice a week, and the rest of the time I can work from home. That'd be awesome. You know, that'd be great.
It would be awesome.
Yeah, you probably got to get going. Exciting. So I don't want to take up too much more of your time.
I wasn't pointing to my watch. I was telling my watch to shut up. But
It's all right. Listen, Alan, this has been great. We should do it again and maybe not wait another 6 years for the next one. But I think having that nice gap between the two and sort of seeing how the industry has changed has been really interesting for sure. So I really appreciate you being on.
Yeah, when it's safe to catch up, we can go to Culver City and get some beers.
Yeah, that'd be great. Awesome, there's some great restaurants there for sure. Hopefully they're still around. I haven't been to them in a long time.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Like, there's so many restaurants. I'm like, I can't wait to go here, and I'm like, I hope it's still there.
Yeah,
there's a bar that just opened up down the street from me, and I was so happy for the week that I got to experience it before. And I'm just like, I felt so bad for them. Yeah,
that's a shame. But now it's been absolutely great. So thank you so much, Alan. I appreciate it.